good afternoon. It's good morning to Sherwin and Tim, co-founders of Tarsier Spirit, a very successful brand. Thank you both for blessing us with your company. I know you're extremely busy, especially coming out of Chinese New Year, a busy period for you and your customers. So I really appreciate you taking some time out to speak to us and sharing your story. First question, which will hopefully be a really easy one, is at the very essence of Tarsier Spirits, what is it that you're trying to do?
So we actually started in 2018. We're just coming up to 6 years now. And when it all started, we just saw a big gap in the gin category. There are a lot of craft gins around at that time, a lot coming through, but nobody really focusing on authentic Southeast Asian flavors. Despite Thai food, Vietnamese food being so popular all around the world, nobody's really going into that sort of flavor palette. So we thought, why not do it ourselves?
Right. Okay. So you're absolutely right. I think the craft gin market is bustling, but perhaps it got to a point where there was a lot of Me Too sort of stuff out in the market and Southeast Asian flavors coming through. You're right. It's a complete differentiator. So the flavorings
also,
that
you brought
them through.
Obviously, the craft gin market, the gin category, has always been looked at as, you know, British and Dutch. But I don't know if you know which country actually drinks the most gin in the world in terms of volume.
I mean, I have an inkling, okay, Sherwin, but please.
So the Philippines drinks 43% of the global volume. So, you know, there's a. Exactly.
Which I'm shocked by, to be absolutely honest by. I'm so shocked by that because I think San Miguel, being half Filipino myself, having the experience that I do, which is very limited, unfortunately, but I would thought it was beer entire way through.
Exactly. Gin so we shocks thought, me. You know, as a Filipino, I wanted to represent my heritage within that space, especially with gin, and we needed to put a brand together that, you know, represents, I guess, our place within the category. And that's why that part of the reason that we started this as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's brilliant. And that was one of my questions is why did we pick gin?
Right.
And you're absolutely right. Philippines is the hugest market coming across. When I was delving into some of this research, it came across in the 1830s. It's really become popularized by, you know, San Miguel, which all of a sudden started to make sense to me. But very much old school gin, right? High proof, very much strong flavors. The nascent gin that we understand it to be out in market. But that I think you've hit the nail on the head around it's starting and rooting from your Filipino heritage. And I'm guessing there's some alignment with Tarsier's and the Filipino heritage there. I don't think many people would know what that animal is, but you've thought it was so important to name your entire company around it. Can you tell us a bit more about Tarsier's and why has that become the emblem of Tarsier Spirits?
Yeah, so they're one of the smallest primates in the world, native to Southeast Asia. So certainly in the Philippines, you see them on the island of Bohol. They've got very localized populations as well. So they tend to just congregate around a couple of areas, which is actually quite bad for their survival. Because if they are affected by things like deforestation, being stolen from the wild for the pet trade, because they are really cute little creatures, all of this affects their populations. And they have been declining. They are endangered. I think there's only about 5,000 left. So we thought, well, let's do something to give back with this brand. And let's do something focused on the Philippines, focused on Asia, because that's where we got our inspiration from. And the Tarsier's kind of summed up what we were when we started. This really small batch gin, just trying to fight our way in the jungle against all these big predator brands, like all the big established brands. And it just seemed like such a cool idea to be this little brand just trying to make their way.
And also, they're such an icon in the Philippines, you know. They're on the money, they're on the T-shirts. So, you know, every Filipino, you know what Italcia is. But if you go outside of the Philippines, or if you go outside Indonesia, if you go outside of Malaysia, not many people have heard about them. And so what we wanted to do is to kind of, like what Tim is saying, is to represent, I guess, our brand in a way that it, you know, gives back to the region that inspired us, but also to kind of, you know, what is so iconic to the Philippines that we can also, that would represent us. But also we went to the sanctuary and learned about them. So that's why, you know, the conservation part of the brand, that's important to us.
So yeah, 10% of the profits that we make, we donate to conservation projects, starting with the Philippine Tarsier Foundation. We're looking to expand that to other conservation projects in the future.
Oh, fab. And I think that's it from knowing Philippines, from knowing, of course, some of the islands. I'm Cebuana, so Bohol is right across the water. And you understand that also Philippines is still, it's on the cusp of becoming the Thailand, getting the infrastructure. And a lot of people, particularly from the West, probably still haven't discovered the beauties that Philippines offers. And the wildlife is so unique. And I think the spirit of Tarsier Spirits is really putting that on the platform, getting people curious, getting people interested. And I think this fits in with the wider movement of more representation of Philippines in spirits in general. I feel like there's an emerging movement, and Tarsier Spirits has really played a part in that. So you've mentioned that you're a brand with purpose. That's clearly core to your values as a business. Do you feel like that's what came first? Is we need to do something here, and actually, what can we do to support with this business? Or was it more, There's an opportunity here with these flavors and the umami that I think is always affiliated with food. Was that the pull first, and actually there was some synergies to be had?
And it all came about by the two of us going traveling around the Philippines, Cambodia, Vietnam, and Thailand. And I mean, that was my first trip out to that part of the world. Obviously, Sharon was born there, so he was more familiar with those flavors, and it just kind of blew me away, the complexity of flavor, but also the kind of innate ability of the people over there to just combine flavors in such a way that it's just simple ingredients, simple cooking techniques, but an explosion of flavor. And that's what we wanted to take forward with our gins. And then the conservation side of things, that came kind of in tandem as we were deciding on the brand and trying to come up with an identity. It all kind of fit into place because we saw the Tarsiers at the sanctuary on our trip. So everything we've done kind of goes back to that backpacking trip that we took, and the brand has been built based on our experiences of going around Asia.
But also, I want to add as well that during our trip, we actually were part of this tour. On the islands of Palawan, there was a couple that we met who set up this business called Tao Philippines, and from there we kind of thought, well, you know what, you can actually set up a business, but then give back to the communities. And what they were doing was that the tour was giving back 20% of their income to the local communities within the islands, like that they were visiting. And I thought that gave me such an inspiration to start a business that has actually got a purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. And for someone who, I've started my career in social enterprise as well, it feels like that model just stands, it's a sustainable model in itself. Business, you're not relying on people's donations, but you're actually building income for such a worthy cause, and you can have the choice to share that with these foundations. So I think it's brilliant work that you're doing. But let's face it, the idea of starting a business and the actual doing of starting a business is incredibly brave, I think. There's a lot to it. Like, how do you get from starting an idea to making it a reality? What sort of process did you have to go through?
Well, to begin with, we had to learn about gin distillation, because we were coming at this with no technical knowledge. It was just an idea. And every approach we've taken has been self-led. So we could have gone to a consultant and said, right, make us a gin, gone to a design agency, design us a brand. We did it all ourselves. So it took a lot longer than it would have otherwise, but it came from a much more kind of authentic place of self. And it was translating our experiences of our travels into the liquids, into the bottle design. So the first step was, well, let's just see if this is actually viable. Can we make a gin using Asian botanicals that tastes really good? Because if you don't have a good liquid, then it's just going to fall flat. So that was 3 years. That was 3 years on and off of just recipe development, learning about distillation, and doing it all self-taught. So we got to the point where after trying, I think it's about 65 different iterations on our friends, the first of which weren't very good, but we got to a point, to put it mildly, they didn't even resemble gin, to be honest. But eventually we got to a point where we thought, hold on, okay, we've got something here. We've got something that tastes totally different. Because that was the other thing that was really important to us. We didn't want to release a gin that tastes very traditional and it's just got a token Asian botanical in it. That wasn't authentic to what we were trying to do. So this needed to taste totally different to anything else out there while still being tasty, while still being gin. And as I said, it took 3 years to get to that point. And when we did, then it was kind of the scary bit. Then it's like, right, okay, we now need to somehow set up a distillery, buy the equipment, come up with a brand, and release this all on an incredibly limited budget. So I think we...
See, I told you, scary.
I think we started with about £15,000 loan, like a government-backed startup loan, and just started from a very small base. We were in the back of a pub with a 60-litre copper alembic still, producing tiny amounts at a time, but it was a place to start, and we've just built it from there.
I feel like that's I don't know, a sign of the times that we have access to so much information that we can self-teach, that we can become self-made through our own learning. I feel like becoming a distiller, there is no one route in. The amount of stories we've heard from different interviews that we've done through this podcast, it's just really interesting to see such different routes in and that access. You talked about, I mean, this authenticity is really strong. It comes through in your website. It's how you talk about Tarsier spirits. Why do you think it's so important? You mentioned on a website, your work has been completely done by you. It was important that you got that flavor palette. You are craft through and through. You've never outsourced anything. Why is that such an important pull for Tarsier?
Because we wanted to, as I said, kind of touched on earlier, we didn't want to have a token nod towards Asia. We didn't want to make a British gin with, throw a little bit of ginger in there, or a little bit of
lemongrass. Yeah,
that's another classic Asian flavor. Partly because we'd seen that being done in the industry, and for us, having traveled around Asia, having experienced some of the most amazing food, we thought there's so much more to Asia than just lemongrass and ginger.
And what we're actually offering is we're not even scratching the surface of what we're offering at the minute. There's a lot more flavors that we could offer, but obviously you have to kind of commercialize it at some point, so.
Well, that's exciting. So that just means there's future releases coming up. Now we can just all guess what's next.
So it's all about doing Asia proud as well, I think. We wanted a gin that would be served in some of the top venues, some of the top bars, hotels, restaurants in Asia, that they'd be proud to serve. That they would think, right,
yeah, absolutely,
you guys have taken our flavors and actually done something pretty cool with them.
Yeah, and also the thing is, you know, if you're going to start a brand and if you're going to, yeah, obviously with the whole gin boom, everyone kind of just went into that, and you know, there's loads of brands that have got money that were able to just then call a contract distiller to say, look, make me a brand, this is what I'm thinking, put it together, just to kind of, I guess, ride the wave. But for us, it's more about where, okay, so this is the category. I mean, having come from the drinks industry, working for giants like Diageo, they give you an understanding of how, you know, what the spirits category is like. And what happens is that we wanted to look at the gin category and say, what's actually missing? Where do we actually fit? Because there's no point in you just bringing a brand that is just a replica of other brands out there. And we wanted a bottle that you know, sits in the category to say, this is Southeast Asia. This is what's representative of the flavors of Southeast Asia. Yes, you have Japanese brands. Yes, you have, you know, British brands that represent Britain or a locality in Britain, but there's nothing that was screaming out, you know, the flavors of Cambodia, Philippines, Thailand, Vietnam. And that's what we wanted to do with the first release, the Southeast Asian Dry.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly that flagship release was bringing ingredients that some or most people wouldn't even have heard of. So you're talking about like calamansi. Everyone's
it's
like,
it's actually
what
interesting,
is that?
Leanne, because like we were going into trade shows and bringing out the calamansi that we use in our distillation, and people were thinking, what is that? Is that an olive? And then picking
oh,
it up
brilliant.
And I go, what? I've never seen that before. What is it? And so part of our brand is about education as well.
That's interesting. And you've talked about your background, Sherwin, and you've like you said, you've worked with giants like Diageo, but you also worked in hospitality for quite some time, working your way through up in your career. Is that right?
Yeah. So I started, like, I was a student, obviously, in Newcastle and doing biology. And part of, you know, my experience, I guess, living in Newcastle, I wanted to work behind the bar. And I worked as a glass collector to start with, in a really upcoming bar back then that was visited by Anton Deck. And we were the first bar in Newcastle to actually do free pour, which they stopped doing. Because they realized that we were making so there's so much wastage from free pouring. So yeah, I worked my way up as a glass collector, and then I went behind the bar, and then from then I just got itch of, you know, working in the drinks industry, that I thought, well, what are the careers available out there? And obviously, you know, as an Asian person, you're being told that you need to do something academic, right? So you're either, because you're
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Because, you know, your cousin is a nurse, your other cousin is a doctor, so therefore you have to do something scientific, right?
Yeah, I told my mother I wanted to work for a charity.
Exactly.
She was not happy.
What a disappointment. Especially when you're saying that, oh, by the way, I'm working behind the bar now. Like, I'm not going to do anything scientific with my degree or anything academic. I'm actually going to start working behind the bar. Yeah, that was such a
Bless
disappointment.
You.
So, yeah. So,
well, as yeah. an aside, who's laughing now? But okay.
So I worked my way through, and then I went to a telesales role in Carlsberg, and then from then I jumped on to an account manager role with Diageo.
Yeah, so I mean, you've got an interesting perspective of both how bartenders use the drinks, the flavors, and obviously the cocktail trend hasn't reduced. It's if not in abundance now, with new RTDs being released on a daily basis. It feels like, but you've got that bartender perspective, but you've also got that commercial approach to things, and it's almost like your experience has lined its way to this that's creating this venture and that surely has had some influence on the success.
Yeah. And also, I think, you know, if you're going to release a brand, I think one thing that people forget is, you know, when they release a brand, they, you know, they kind of seem to think that, I guess, just sitting back and then getting the distributor to actually, once you sell into the distributor, then the work is done, because that is expected with the distributor to actually go and sell the brand for you. But you have to think, where does your brand sit in that portfolio? You know, how are you going to offer value to the customer? And also, you know, don't forget about getting and, you know, hitting the streets and actually like talking to bartenders and actually going into the venues and actually seeing what the environment is like and see if your brand is going to fit that venue, if they're going to sell just one bottle in 6 months or if they're going to sell two or three bottles per week, you know? So it's, my advice is to hit the streets and actually go and sell the bottle yourself. And as much as you're still the founder and, you know, you still have to do the hard graft and actually getting that bottle moved, you know, and getting that pull through.
That's really interesting and not something that's come up before, but I think is a really valid point is when you are starting out as a craft gin, you're creating success. A huge partner that you're reliant on is the distribution networks. Once you've got a really quality, distinctive brand, now it's getting it out there into the market. So you mentioned there about how actually it's as much about selecting the right distributor as it is about them choosing you to be onboarded as part of their portfolio. Was that true for you? Did you have to actually explore and research a few? Was it more proactive in your approach of who you wanted to work with?
So there's two approaches to this. One, I mean, there's been distributors that we have just met while being on a trade mission to Hong Kong. So Taiwan, for example, happened because the distributor was in the city. And looking to renew his visa, and he found a brand on Instagram, and that's how we met. We discussed his business. One thing you need to understand first, if you're going to go with the distributor, is, you know, A, how does your brand fit in that portfolio? B, what's their strategy? You know, who do they sell to? Do they sell mainly on the on-trade, the off-trade, e-commerce? You just need to understand, you know, where does your brand actually sit in terms of, you know, is it more direct to consumer? Is it more on trade? You know, do you have any kind of gifting proposition? But also you need to understand that, like, is this the distributor that you can work with? You know, our rule is that myself and Tim is always, can we go for a beer with this guy, you know, and establish that relationship. And if you can't go for a beer with your distributor, then there's no point having that working with them, because you won't be able to build that relationship and business as well as, I guess, a friendship with them, because especially with export, you know. One is approaching them, obviously sending a load of emails to prospective people. And then the other is, you know, we get requests from distributors, from exporters all the time. And especially now, there's a lot of those kind of scam emails that's going out there. One thing that I'd say is that if you are getting these emails, make sure that they are legit. Find out if that person actually exists on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is a great source of information in terms of, you know, just verifying their position and their company. B, find out if they've got a website. I know quite a lot, some distributors, especially in countries like South America or some in Asia, they don't have a website, but the third role is to always arrange a virtual meeting with them and make sure that they actually exist and understand, you know, where, you know, if they are selling already into the market, then they should know where your product sits and who your competitors are. And they should understand what the strategies are and how they're going to sell your brand into their territory.
That's really good advice. It sounds like learned advice, and it sounds like some we want to prevent a few people learning the hard way.
This took a few mistakes until we learn how, you know, to kind of navigate our export journey now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I think I'm going to swing back a little later on the perspective of bartenders, because I'm always interested as almost custodians of the brand in front of the customer. But you touched on the relationship and the reliance on distributors for their advice, their insights in country markets. That leads me to think about the strategic distinctiveness of Tarsier anyway. And we talk about in our industry as Signet, working in embellishments and labels, we talk a lot about shelf appeal, standing out from the crowd and being remembered. How did you want Tarsier to stand out against your competitors?
Really, we just wanted something that looked totally different to everything else out there. I guess that's why we took the decision to do all the branding ourselves, do the design ourselves, because we saw there are three ways of doing it. One, spend a lot of money on a really good design agency and have something really unique. We didn't have a lot of money. The other one is spend a small amount of money, but then you risk getting something that's a bit more off the shelf, I guess, a bit more generic spirits label. Or the third approach is just do it yourself. And that's the one we went for. We've done it ourselves, it takes a lot longer. So it's one of those things that if we could have done this all again, probably get some money and go down the professional route and just get it done a lot quicker. But we did it our own way, and it was a long journey. We're on to our third iteration of the kind of bottle and brand design at the moment.
And that's an interesting question, because, I mean, of course, I've noticed that, and it's very natural for that progression to happen. I mean, you're almost doing short testing with your customers in smaller markets, growing, getting that feedback. And I think that's just a really valid way of getting that insight. But what we see now out in market and the previous iteration, what made you think, do you know what, Sherwin, we need a rethink here, and actually I think a redesign might be exactly what we need? What were the indicators that made you think it's time?
First of all, the Tarsier, that's actually the image that's actually on the bottle, that was actually done by my cousin. So he drew that from a pencil drawing, and because I had an idea of what I wanted the brand to look like, you know, like I said, going back from my experience at Diageo, you look at the Johnnie Walker label, for example, and Johnnie Walker bottle, there was a reason why they made it square so that it could fit onto the case. There's a reason why the label is skewed so that it, you know, if you're looking at whiskey, the Johnnie Walker label with its skewed label would stand out against the other whiskey brands. And for us, it was like taking the Tarsier and putting it right in front of the bottle so that it would ask, you know, so there's a conversation starter. What is that thing? You know, but that was drawn by my cousin. It only cost me a lechon for his wedding, which I think...
I love that. That's a very good deal.
We were getting quotes of about £3,000, and all it cost me was £100 for a roast pig for his wedding. And then, so we designed...
which for our audience is, it's very, very good and is worth the visit to Philippines. But I,
so then
brilliant.
We had to kind of design everything around it. And we first went in with, we first launched with a square bottle. But what we found was that if the a back bar is, you know, is crowded, what they tend to do was put the bottle on the side. So all you see is the side of the bottle, not the actual branding. So that's why we moved on to a circular, a round bottle, so that we have that shelf presence. And the other reason was that we started with a 50 centiliter bottle, and then we had to go to a 70 centiliter. Because the feedback that we were getting was that as much as I love your liquid, the price per shot, in order to incorporate it into a drinks menu or a cocktail, it doesn't equate for us to actually to include your brand into the serve, because the price per shot was so expensive. So that's why we increased the size to 70 centiliter from a 50 centiliter to give more value to consumers as well as the bars.
And the other thing to say about the first bottle, and this is a really good bit of advice, is don't think about the now when it comes to your design decisions. Think a year down the line. So what might be okay to do now, when you scale up and you're doing 5-10 times the volume, is it still achievable with your design choices? So with our square bottle, we were labeling by hand. And the way that we got the label in the same position each time was actually to design a jig that we then 3D printed the label, because it was a long label that wrapped around three sides of a rectangular bottle. So it's not a very easy label to apply. We'd put it in this jig that was the exact outline of the bottle, because again, it was a non-standard shaped label as well. We did things that we thought, that looks nice. We did think through, is that actually practical? So the amount of time to label each bottle and to get each one looking uniform, it was a lot. And that's fine when you're first starting out and you're not doing big volumes. But then as your volumes increase, it's like, well, we're spending so much time just getting this label on. Whereas if we had a round bottle, there's so many machines that start from quite cheap and you can get better machines as you go along. It's so much easier with a round bottle. So it's that kind of thing. Just think ahead. Do I want to do this when I'm doing thousands of bottles? It's fine when you're doing 50 or 100 in a batch. When your batches go to 1,000, 1,500, can you still do that?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's such an excellent point, Tim, and something that we see with clients as well. And but I guess it's very easy to go straight into what feels good, what looks good, what says something about our brand, but not think about, well, how does this then lend itself to mass manufacture? Because that's the end goal for a lot of people, is to scale and to scale most cost effectively. And what do you, starting to think about the design of the bottle beyond the production, to go, well, how is it going to transfer to Australia and to US markets? And is it still going to get damaged en route? And all these complexities of how is it going to get applied to the bottle? These are things that need to be considered from that design phase. 100%. And I think you've shared that example through and through with your experience there. So that's really interesting. And can I ask why we decided the type of bottle? So it's not a glass bottle, is it? It's a is it resin or?
It is a glass bottle. So we decided to move to a round bottle for ease of label application. Move to a 70cl bottle because it's just better value for the consumer, for the bars. And we really like the kind of apothecary style bottle, but it's such a popular bottle in that there's a lot of brands that use it. So had we just stayed with clear glass with a label on it, we're not achieving our objective of standing out, looking different. Now, ideally, you'd go into your own custom bottle, so you really are in a unique bottle. But we didn't have the funds to do that. So it's like, right, how can we take something off the shelf but make it look custom? And we thought, right, let's do that through decoration. So that leads us on to our second iteration of the brand, where we had the kind of apothecary bottle. We thought, let's get it sprayed black and then apply a label. But because of the design we had in our minds, we wanted almost full coverage with a label. And that's what we did, because nobody said, oh, don't do that, that's a ridiculous idea. Because we're doing it on ourselves, and we were learning from our mistakes rather than taking other people's learnings, I guess. So we ended up with this full coverage bottle, loads of foil on it, it looked gorgeous. But applying it to a bottle that has rounded edges as it goes up, we were right on the limit of flat surface to apply that label to. So we spent so much time trying to push down creases or like buff out creases with cloths. The vision in our heads was like, this is going to look amazing. The reality is we didn't take the physical characteristics of the bottle into account, because getting a long wraparound label in the exact positioning so it sticks down properly, very difficult. So that then led us on to our third iteration, which was, wow, let's just get this bottle decorated. Let's get it sprayed, screen printed, and then foiled, but keeping this full wraparound design, because then it just looks like nothing else out there. And that's what we achieved. But again, we were going to decorators asking them to do something they hadn't really done before. They hadn't done that much foil on the bottle for good reason, because every time you add an additional process to a decoration line, you add in issues or potential issues. There's always going to be things out of line, out of tolerance, and we're asking this bottle decorator to get everything lined up. The screen print needs to be lined up with the foil, and it's all different processes. And we ended up with a decorated bottle that wasn't where we wanted it to be, because of all of those errors that got introduced. Meant maybe one in two were absolutely good standards, and the others weren't. And that we kind of felt, well, this is almost damaging the brand if we're having to send out bottles that aren't absolutely perfect. The way we got around that was eventually finding a decorator that could do it, that could do what we had in mind. They had innovative techniques they could use. They gave us advice on how we could change the design slightly so that everything would line up. You're going to get a really good return rate on your bottle, so not too many spoil. But that's another big thing. If you're sending, say, 2,000 bottles to get decorated and a quarter of them are wasted, that's getting less bottles than you expected. It's also pushing the price up.
High cost. So, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and it's these things we didn't consider because we just didn't know. We thought, oh, we'll send our bottles to get decorated, they'd all come back looking absolutely identical, and it'll be for this certain price. We didn't take the wastage into account, which really pushed that cost of goods up. But then it was finding a decorator, it's actually in Germany, the one that we use, that could do what we wanted them to do. The only issue there was they had a minimum order quantity of over 10,000 units per SKU. And so we now have five different SKUs. You'll see that only two of them are fully decorated, our Southeast Asian Dry and our Oriental Pink. And that's because we didn't have the cash flow or the space in our distillery to get over 10,000 of each SKU. That would be 50,000 different bottles that we need to get every order. So we thought, let's stick with our core range, the black and the pink bottles, really distinctive. And then for every other release, we'll go back to labels, because it just means that we only need three different bottles being decorated, because the other bottles are just a white spray coat and a label. So it's those kind of considerations.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually, when I was looking at it, it almost forms its own collection. It's almost like a little traveler's collection, because you've got the Khaosan, you've got the Taipei Old Tom, and then you've got the Calamansi citrus. I feel like it's like there's a little traveler expedition there. And then you've got your flagships. If anyone hasn't tried the Oriental Pink Gin, they must. It is a winner chicken dinner. So do try it. I had the opportunity to do that at BCB Berlin. So please do so. I think the look, I mean, it's taken three iterations, but you've achieved something very special. And I just want to highlight the fact that, you know, the stopper is wooden. I feel like because you're a values-driven organization, sustainability is something that's quite, you know, increasingly valuable to you and something that is important to you. What a lot of people talk about sustainability in this industry, particularly around packaging. What does it mean for you as a brand?
Okay, so in terms of obviously we do a lot of our business abroad. So we had to look at the bottle and actually how much it weighs. So now where our bottle is 40% lighter than standard bottles out there, because for us most of our business is exports. I think 80% of our business is exports. So we were sending heavy bottles previously, and if there's a way that we could actually reduce the weight and the emissions with deliveries to other countries, then the bottle, I guess, was the first thing that we obviously had to reduce the weight. The second is that the actual cork itself is made of wood. Now, we used to use paper as well to seal the bottle, the stopper. And then what we found was that the actual images on the paper, we actually laser etched that now onto the cork. So A, it removes another step for us, and B, it actually gives the stopper a lot more of a distinct look rather than just having a paper seal over it. And the other thing that we're also, in terms of the packaging, those are the improvements that we've done in order to reduce our emission and our impact. But the other way that we are actually putting sustainability as part of our business process is that we are using a very modern still. Now, we use a still called an ice still, which is heavily insulated, which means that we're saving quite a lot of energy when we're distilling, especially if you're, you know, putting this still on for what, 10 to 12 hours. The way that we are reducing our emissions here is that we use the ice still uses four times less energy than copper pot stills. So it's great in a world where the energy crisis at the minute is, you know, and then also we are using a rotobat, which means that we're extracting flavor in low temperatures, and it's a very efficient way of actually extracting flavors for us and adding it to our gin base. And that normally takes about 30 minutes, and everything that we're using is electric.
That's immense, because what you've highlighted there, Sherwin, is for a lot of people, when they think about sustainability, it's about how they project that look and whether they embody those values or not. It's just how we look more sustainable. But actually, you hit the nail on the head there. You're thinking wider. Not many people think about the weight of their bottles and how that could actually contribute to emissions, which contributes it could be contributing to cost savings, but also sustainability. And it's a really important note there. And the activity of continually improving our own processes. I think that's really valuable for people to note that sustainability in design can also be something really impactful when it comes to thinking about your emissions as a business. I'm conscious of your time, but I've just got a couple of other questions about what's next, basically. Tarsher, if I read rightly, and I so it was maybe a couple of years ago now, you were exporting into 20 different countries, probably more. What's next for Tarsher Spirits?
So it's building the brand abroad, focusing on key markets to really, we want to be known as the go-to Southeast Asian gin. So that's our end goal. How we get there, we're actually looking at packaging iteration number 4. Now we have more funds to put into our ideas, doing something totally unique, totally custom. I think we've taken the off-the-shelf bottle as far as we can go in terms of making it look unique and custom. And now we've got a vision for how the brand can really, really stand out on shelf.
And I was going to say, and also the thing is that we're doing this as still as a self-funded independent business. So whatever, you know, profits that we make, it goes back into what we're doing. Because the way that we see it is that we're building an asset into the brand. And what we wanted to also do is to, you know, I guess own that the Asian kind of heritage in a very white dominated space, and we wanted to, and you will see that with our releases, because it's not just gin that we're looking into. Being in this, you know, being in this space and looking back and understanding our impact and our forgotten influences within the drinks industry, we want Tarsier to be able to grab that influence and actually educate consumers and the bartending community about the forgotten influences, that especially the Filipinos bartenders and the Filipino slaves and immigrants have contributed into what it is, you know, the current landscape of the spirits category.
That's a phenomenal. Thank you for sharing that, Sherwin. I think that's pretty powerful stuff. And I guess one thing you've been really open in sharing your experiences and your insights along this journey. And it feels like when we talk to each other that it has been 10 years. Because it's been obviously a very rapid cycle of learning. If you knew then what you know now, what is the one thing you'd have done differently if you'd had the chance?
Wow. Probably get the packaging right from day one. Like, if we'd launched in what we have now, I think we could have accelerated our journey a lot quicker. But equally, it's like what we did was all part of the journey to get to where we are now. So would we have had the same trajectory without going through those trial and error learnings? It's hard to say, but it would have certainly sped things up.
Sherwin, do you feel the same way?
For me, I think it's starting this 10 years ago, you know, when I had the inkling, because, you know, going back into, like I said, like my experience in the spirits industry, what I found was that the emergence of craft gin brands, and as the year went on, I was like saying, they're missing a trick here. We need to launch a gin brand. We need to do, and we waited 8 years into it until we launched this brand. And I, you know, if you've got a gut instinct, trust it and go with it.
I like that. I like that a lot. And in fact, if there's a resounding feeling that comes from some of the interviews that we have had with different distillers across the world, that is a pattern that people come back with, is had an instinct. I wish I'd just trusted myself. But even then, I think that aligns with what Tim's saying, is sometimes it's the journey that allows you to feel like you can trust yourself and that confidence. So definitely do not beat yourself up about that, because you have built together something incredible. Before my last close, if you were to encapsulate Tarshur Spirits in one word, this is my favorite question. One word or phrase I will give you, what would it be?
Authentic Asian experience.
That's good. I like that. Original. Sherwin, do you feel
yeah,
that's...
Yeah, so what yeah. I wanted to do is, I guess, yeah, I'd echo that. I think for me, it's about, it's, yeah, being able to escape, you know, from the ordinary.
I love that. Authentication experience that helps you escape from the ordinary. That is the next slogan, guys. Yes. I'll get my lecture on whenever you're ready. I'll be waiting. I will bring it to a close on that note. Thank you both so much, not just for your time today, but I'm really grateful for what you're trying to do on a personal note. You know, that representation is so important for Southeast Asia and Far East culture, but I think it's so important that you have taken those learnings and you're so happy and open to share them with others in the industry that might follow suit. So I really appreciate everything that you're doing and the successes that you're having. And I certainly know that our team are watching your Instagram practically every day, seeing what you're up to and all the antics. And I must say, is a testament to exactly what you've shared here, is going out there, meeting clients, meeting new bars, understanding how people are using your spirits and how to improve continually. And I think that's a sign of a really strong and up and coming and successful brand. And I wish you all the best of luck. If I can probably ask you for one more thing, is I would love to return back to you in a year and a half, and find out how you've been keeping, especially if this new rebrand comes alive, which I know it will. I would love to know where you're at with your journey as you move through it, and hopefully be a part of it where we can.